side between him and the doorway, and Stragella writhed forward with one alabaster arm, feeling. He was conscious of the roar of surf very close, very loud outside the walls of the fog-filled enclosure. The ship was lurching, reeling heavily, pitching in the swell. Hours must have passed. Hours and hours of darkness and horror. Then she touched him. The sticky stuff was hot on his chest, moving in a slow circle. He hurled himself back, stumbled, went down, and she fell upon him. Under his tormented body, the floor of the cabin split asunder. The ship buckled from top to bottom with a grinding, roaring impact. A terrific shock burst through the ancient hulk, shattering its rotted timbers. The lamp caromed off the table, plunging the cabin in semi-darkness. Through the portholes filtered a grey glare. Stragella's face, thrust into Yance's, became a mask of beautiful fury. She whirled back. She stood rigid, screaming lividly to Papa Bochito and the old hag. "Go back! Go back!" she railed. "We have waited too long! It is dawn!" She ran across the floor, grappling with them. Her lips were distorted, her body trembled. She hurled her companions to the door. Then, as she followed them into the gloom of the passage, she turned upon Yancey with a last, unholy snarl of defeated rage. And she was gone. Yancey lay limp. When he struggled to his feet at last and went on deck, the sun was high in the sky, bloated and crimson, struggling to penetrate the cone of fog which swirled about the ship. The ship lay far over, creaned on her side. 100 yards distant over the port rail lay the heaven-sent sight of land, a bleak, vacant expanse of jungle-rimmed shoreline. He went deliberately to work, a task that had to be finished quickly, lest he be discovered by the inhabitants of the shore and be considered stark mad. Returning to the cabin, he took the oil lamp and carried it to the open hold. There, sprinkling the liquid over the ancient wood, he set fire to it. Turning, he stepped to the rail. A scream of agony, unearthly and prolonged, rose up behind him. Then he was over the rail, battling in the surf. When he staggered up on the beach, 20 minutes later, the Golconda was a roaring furnace. On all sides of her the flames snarled skyward, spewing through that hellish cone of vapour. Grimly, Yancey turned away and trudged along the beach. He looked back after an hour of steady plodding. The lagoon was empty. The fog had vanished. The sun gleamed down with warm brilliance on a broad, empty expanse of sea. Hours later he reached a settlement. Men came and talked to him and asked curious questions. They pointed to his hair, which was stark white. They told him he had reached Port Blair, on the southern island of the Andamans. After that, noticing the peculiar gleam of his bloodshot eyes, they took him to the home of the governor. There he told his story, told hesitantly because he expected to be disbelieved, mocked. The governor looked at him cryptically.
"You don't expect me to understand?" the governor said. "I'm not so sure, sir. This is a penal colony, a prison isle. During the past few years, more than 200 of our convicts have died in the most curious way. 2 tiny punctures in the throat. Loss of blood."
"You must destroy the graves!" Yancey muttered.
The governor nodded silently. Significantly. After that, Yancey returned to the world alone. Always alone. Men peered into his face and shrank away from the haunted stare of his eyes. They saw the crucifix upon his chest and wondered why, day and night, he wore his shirt flapping open so that the brilliant design glared forth. But their curiosity was never appeased. Only Yancey knew. And Yancey was silent.
Marcius in Flanders by Vernon Lee. Vernon Lee is the pseudonym of Violet Paget, 1856 to 1935, a British writer who was born in Boulogne, France. She was the half-sister of Eugene Lee Hamilton, from whose surname she took her nom de plume. She lived for a time in London, but moved to a hillside outside Florence in 1889 and lived there until her death. She wrote prodigiously on 18th-century Italian art, music, and architecture, and became a member of the aesthetic movement, meeting both the movement's effective leader, Walter Pater, and its most renowned member, Oscar Wilde. She contributed poems to its most famous publication, The Yellow Book. She is, however, mainly remembered today for her supernatural fiction. The most important scholar of Gothic and supernatural fiction, Montague Summers, wrote that she should be ranked ahead of M.R. James as the greatest modern exponent of the supernatural in fiction. Her reputation would undoubtedly have been enhanced had she written more stories, of which there are fewer than 20. Perhaps her most famous is the novella A Phantom Lover, often reprinted as Oak of Oakhurst. Her most important short story collection is Hauntings, 1890. Marcius in Flanders was first published in a magazine in 1900, then was collected in Four Morris, Five Unlikely Tales, London, John Lane, The Bodley Head, 1927.
Marcius in Flanders by Vernon Lee. Read by Jonathan Cowley. Part 1. You are right. This is not the original crucifix at all. Another one has been put instead. Il y a eu substitution. And the little old antiquary of June's nodded mysteriously, fixing his ghost-seer's eyes upon mine. He said it in a scarce, audible whisper, for it happened to be the vigil of the Feast of the Crucifix, and the once-famous church was full of semi-clerical persons decorating it for the morrow, and of old ladies in strange caps, clattering about with pails and brooms. The antiquary had brought me there the very moment of my arrival, lest the crowd of faithful should prevent his showing me everything next morning. The famous crucifix was exhibited behind rows and rows of unlit candles, and surrounded by strings of paper flowers and coloured muslin, and garlands of sweet resinous maritime pine, and two lighted chandeliers illumined it. "There has been an exchange," he repeated, looking round that no one might hear him. "Il y a eu substitution." For I had remarked, as anyone would have done, at the first glance, that the crucifix had every appearance of French work of the 13th century, boldly realistic, whereas the crucifix of the legend, which was a work of St. Luke, which had hung for centuries in the Holy Sepulchre at Jerusalem, had been miraculously cast ashore at Dunes in 1195, would surely have been a more or less Byzantine image, like its miraculous companion of Lucca. "But why should there have been a substitution?" I inquired innocently. "Hush, hush," answered the antiquary, frowning. "Not here. Later, later." He took me all over the church, once so famous for pilgrimages, but from which, even like the sea which has left it in a salt marsh beneath the cliffs, the tide of devotion has receded for centuries. It is a very dignified little church, of charmingly restrained and shapely Gothic, built of a delicate pale stone, which the sea damp has picked out, in bases and capitals and carved foliation, with stains of a lovely bright green. The antiquary showed me where the transept and belfry had been left unfinished when the miracles had diminished in the 14th century. And he took me up to the curious warder's chamber, a large room up some steps in the triforium, with a fireplace and stone seats for the men who guarded the precious crucifix day and night. There had even been beehives in the window, he told me, and he remembered seeing them still as a child. "Was it usual here in Flanders to have a guardroom in churches containing important relics?" I asked, for I could not remember having seen anything similar before. "By no means," he answered, looking round to make sure we were alone. "But it was necessary here. You have never heard in what the chief miracles of this church consisted?" "No," I whispered back, gradually infected by his mysteriousness. "Unless you allude to the legend that the figure of the Saviour broke all the crosses until the right one was cast up by the sea." He shook his head, but did not answer, and descended the steep stairs into the nave, while I lingered a moment looking down into it from the warder's chamber. I have never had so curious an impression of a church. The chandeliers on either side of the crucifix swirled slowly round, making great pools of light which were broken by the shadows of the clustered columns, and among the pews of the nave moved the flicker of the sacristan's lamp. The place was full of the scent of resinous pine branches, evoking dunes and mountainsides, and from the busy groups below rose a subdued chatter of women's voices and a splash of water and clatter of pattens. It vaguely suggested preparation for a witch's Sabbath. "What sort of miracles did they have in this church?" I asked, when we had passed into the dusky square. "And what did you mean about their having exchanged the crucifix, about a substitution?" It seemed quite dark outside. The church rose black, a vague lopsided mass of buttresses and high-pitched roofs, against the watery moonlit sky. The big trees of the churchyard behind wavering about in the sea wind, and the windows shone yellow, like flaming portals in the darkness. "Please remark the bold effect of the gargoyles," said the antiquary, pointing upwards. They jutted out, vague wild beasts, from the roofline, and what was positively frightening, you saw the moonlight, yellow and blue, through the open jaws of some of them. A gust swept through the trees, making the weathercock clatter and groan. "Why, those gargoyle wolves seem positively to howl," I exclaimed. The old antiquary chuckled. "Aha," he answered. "Did I not tell you that this church has witnessed things like no other church in Christendom? And it still remembers them. There, have you ever known such a wild, savage church before?" And as he spoke, there suddenly mingled with the sough of the wind and the groans of the weather vane, a shrill, quavering sound as of pipers inside. "The organist trying his vox humana for tomorrow," remarked the antiquary. Part 2. Next day, I bought one of the printed histories of the miraculous crucifix which they were hawking all round the church. And next day also, my friend the antiquary was good enough to tell me all about what he knew of the matter. Between my two informants, the following may be said to be the true story. In the autumn of 1195, after a night of frightful storm, a boat was found cast upon the shore of Dunes, which was at the time a fishing village at the mouth of the Nis, and exactly opposite a terrible sunken reef. The boat was broken and upset, and close to it, on the sand and bent grass, lay a stone figure of the crucified Saviour, without its cross, and, as seems probable, also without its arms, which had been made of separate blocks. A variety of persons immediately came forward to claim it, the little church of Dunes, on whose gleb it was found, the barons of Croy, who had the right of jetsam on that coast, and also the great abbey of Saint-Loup of Arras, as possessing the spiritual overlordship of the place. But a holy man who lived close by in the cliffs had a vision which settled the dispute. Saint Luke in person appeared and told him that he was the original maker of the figure, that it had been one of three which had hung round the holy sepulchre of Jerusalem, that three knights, a Norman, a Tuscan, and a man of Arras, had, with the permission of heaven, stolen them from the infidels and placed them on unmanned boats, that one of the images had been cast upon the Norman coast near Salonelle, that the second had run aground not far from the city of Lucca in Italy, and that this third was the one which had been embarked by the knight from Artois. As regarded its final resting place, the hermit, on the authority of St. Luke, recommended that the statue should be left to decide the matter itself. Accordingly, the crucified figure was solemnly cast back into the sea. The very next day it was found once more in the same spot, among the sand and the bent grass at the mouth of the Nis. It was therefore deposited in the little church of Dunes, and very soon indeed the flocks of pious persons who brought it offerings from all parts made it necessary and possible to rebuild the church, thus sanctified by its presence. The holy effigy of Dunes, Sacra Dunarum Effigies, as it was called, did not work the ordinary sort of miracles, but its fame spread far and wide by the unexampled wonders which became the constant accompaniment of its existence. The effigy, as above mentioned, had been discovered without the cross to which it had evidently been fastened, nor had any researches or any subsequent storms brought the missing blocks to light, despite the many prayers which were offered for the purpose. After some time, therefore, and a deal of discussion, it was decided that a new cross should be provided for the effigy to hang upon. And certain skilful stonemasons of Arras were called to Dunes for this purpose. But, behold, the very day after the cross had been solemnly erected in the church, an unheard-of and terrifying fact was discovered. The effigy, which had been hanging perfectly straight the previous evening, had shifted its position, and was bent violently to the right, as if in an effort to break loose. This was attested not merely by hundreds of laymen, but by the priest of the place, who notified the fact in a document, existing in the episcopal archives of Arras until 1790, to the abbot of St. Lou, their spiritual overlord. This was the beginning of a series of mysterious occurrences which spread the fame of the marvellous crucifix all over Christendom. The effigy did not remain in the position into which it had miraculously worked itself. It was found at intervals of time, shifted in some other manner upon its cross, and always as if it had gone through violent contortions. And one day, about 10 years after it had been cast up by the sea, the priests of the church and the burghers of Dunes discovered the effigy hanging in its original outstretched, symmetrical attitude, but oh wonder, with the cross broken in 3 pieces, lying on the steps of its chapel. Certain persons who lived in the end of the town nearest the church reported to have been roused in the middle of the night by what they had taken for a violent clap of thunder, but which was doubtless the crash of the cross falling down, or perhaps, who knows, the noise with which the terrible effigy had broken loose and spurned the alien cross from it. For that was the secret. The effigy, made by a saint and come to Dunes by miracle, had evidently found some trace of unholiness in the stone to which it had been fastened. Such was the ready explanation afforded by the prior of the church, in answer to an angry summons of the abbot of St. Lou, who expressed his disapproval of such unusual miracles. Indeed, it was discovered that the piece of marble had not been cleaned from sinful human touch with the necessary rites before the figure was fastened on. A most grave, though excusable, oversight. So a new cross was ordered, although it was noticed that much time was lost about it, and the consecration took place only some years later. Meanwhile, the prior had built the warder's chamber, with the fireplace and recess, and obtained permission from the Pope himself that a clerk in orders should watch day and night on the score that so wonderful a relic might be stolen. For the relic had by this time entirely cut out all similar crucifixes, and the village of Dunes, through the concourse of pilgrims, had rapidly grown into a town, the property of the new fabulously wealthy Priory of the Holy Cross. The abbots of St. Lou, however, looked upon the matter with an unfavourable eye. Although nominally remaining their vassals, the priors of Dunes had contrived to obtain gradually from the Pope privileges which rendered them virtually independent, and in particular, immunities which sent to the treasury of St. Lou only a small proportion of the tribute money brought by the pilgrims. Abbot Walterius, in particular, showed himself actively hostile. He accused the prior of Dunes of having employed his warders to trump up stories of strange movements and sounds on the part of the still crossless effigy, and of suggesting, to the ignorant, changes in its attitude which were more credulously believed in now that there was no longer the straight line of the cross by which to verify. So finally, the new cross was made, and consecrated, and on Holy Cross Day of the year, the effigy was fastened to it in the presence of an immense concourse of clergy and laity. The effigy, it was now supposed, would be satisfied, and no unusual occurrences would increase or perhaps fatally compromise its reputation for sanctity. These expectations were violently dispelled. In November 1293, after a year of strange rumours concerning the effigy, the figure was again discovered to have moved, and continued moving, or rather, judging from the position on the cross, writhing. And on Christmas Eve of the same year, the cross was a second time thrown down and dashed in pieces. The priest on duty was at the same time found, it was thought, dead in his warder's chamber. Another cross was made, and this time privately consecrated and put in place, and a hole in the roof made a pretext to close the church for a while, and to perform the rites of purification necessary after its pollution by workmen. Indeed, it was remarked that on this occasion, the prior of Junes took as much trouble to diminish, and if possible to hide away the miracles, as his predecessor had done his best to blazon the preceding ones abroad. The priest who had been on duty on the eventful Christmas Eve disappeared mysteriously, and it was thought by many persons that he had gone mad and was confined in the prior's prison, for fear of the revelations he might make. For by this time, and not without some encouragement from the abbots at Arras, extraordinary stories had begun to circulate about the goings-on in the Church of Junes. This church, be it remembered, stood a little above the town, isolated and surrounded by big trees. It was surrounded by the precincts of the priory and, save on the waterside, by high walls. Nevertheless, persons there were, who affirmed that, the wind having been in that direction, they had heard strange noises come from the church of nights. During storms particularly, sounds had been heard which were variously described as howls, groans, and the music of rustic dancing. A master mariner affirmed that one Halloween, as his boat approached the mouth of the Nis, he had seen the Church of Junes brilliantly lit up, its immense windows flaming. But he was suspected of being drunk and of having exaggerated the effect of the small light shining from the warder's chamber. The interest of the townsfolk of Junes coincided with that of the priory, since they prospered greatly by the pilgrimages, so these tales were promptly hushed up. Yet they undoubtedly reached the ear of the abbot of St. Lou, and at last there came an event which brought them all back to the surface. For, on the Vigil of All Saints, 1299, the church was struck by lightning. The new warder was found dead in the middle of the nave, the cross broken in two, and, oh horror, the effigy was missing. The indescribable fear which overcame everyone was merely increased by the discovery of the effigy lying behind the high altar, in an attitude of frightful convulsion, and, it was whispered, blackened by lightning. This was the end of the strange doings at Junes. An ecclesiastical council was held at Arras, and the church shut once more for nearly a year. It was opened this time and reconsecrated by the abbot of St. Lou, whom the prior of Holy Cross served humbly at Mass. A new chapel had been built, and in it the miraculous crucifix was displayed, dressed in more splendid brocade and gems than usual, and its head nearly hidden by one of the most gorgeous crowns ever seen before, a gift, it was said, of the Duke of Burgundy. All this new splendour, and the presence of the great abbot himself, was presently explained to the faithful, when the prior came forward to announce that a last and greatest miracle had now taken place. The original cross, on which the figure had hung in the Church of the Holy Sepulchre, and for which the effigy had spurned all others, made by less holy hands, had been cast on the shore of Junes, on the very spot where, 100 years before, the figure of the Saviour had been discovered in the sands. This, said the prior, was the explanation of the terrible occurrences which had filled all hearts with anguish. The holy effigy was now satisfied. It would rest in peace, and its miraculous powers would be engaged only in granting the prayers of the faithful. One half of the forecast came true. From that day forward, the effigy never shifted its position. But from that day forward also, no considerable miracle was ever registered. The devotion of Junes diminished, other relics threw the sacred effigy into the shade, and the pilgrimages dwindling to mere local gatherings, the church was never brought to completion. What had happened? No one ever knew, guessed, or perhaps even asked. But when in 1790 the archiepiscopal palace of Arras was sacked, a certain notary of the neighbourhood bought a large portion of the archives at the price of waste paper, either from historical curiosity, or expecting to obtain thereby facts which might gratify his aversion to the clergy. These documents lay unexamined for many years, till my friend, the antiquary, bought them. Among them, taken helter-skelter from the Archbishop's palace, were sundry papers referring to the suppressed Abbey of St. Lou of Arras, and among these latter, a series of notes concerning the affairs of the Church of Junes. They were, so far as their fragmentary nature explained, the minutes of an inquest made in 1309, and contained the deposition of sundry witnesses. To understand their meaning, it is necessary to remember that this was the time when witch trials had begun, and when the proceedings against the Templars had set the fashion of inquests which could help the finances of the country, while furthering the interests of religion. What appears to have happened is that after the catastrophe of the Vigil of All Saints, October 1299, the prior, Urbain de Luc, found himself suddenly threatened with a charge of sacrilege and witchcraft, of obtaining miracles of the effigy by devilish means, and of converting his church into a chapel of the evil one. Instead of appealing to high ecclesiastical tribunals, as the privileges obtained from the Holy See would have warranted, Prior Urbain guessed that this charge came originally from the wrathful abbot of St. Lou, and, dropping all his pretensions in order to save himself, he threw himself upon the mercy of the abbot whom he had hitherto flouted. The abbot appears to have been satisfied by his submission, and the matter to have dropped after a few legal preliminaries, of which the notes found among the archiepiscopal archives of Arras represented a portion. Some of these notes, my friend the antiquary kindly allowed me to translate from the Latin, and I give them here, leaving the reader to make what he can of them. Item. The abbot expresses himself satisfied that his reverence the prior has had no personal knowledge of or dealings with the evil one, Diabolus. Nevertheless, the gravity of the charge requires, here the page is torn, Hugues Jacquot, Simon le Couvreur, Pierre Denis, burghers of Junes, being interrogated, witness, that the noises from the Church of the Holy Cross always happened on nights of bad storms, and foreboded shipwrecks on the coast, and were very various, such as terrible rattling, groans, howls as of wolves, and occasional flute playing. A certain Jehan, who has twice been branded and flogged for lighting fires on the coast and otherwise causing ships to wreck at the mouth of the Nis, being promised immunity, after two or three slight pulls on the rack, witnesses as follows: that the band of wreckers to which he belongs always knew when a dangerous storm was brewing, on account of the noises which issued from the Church of Junes. Witness has often climbed the walls and prowled round in the churchyard, waiting to hear such noises. He was not unfamiliar with the howlings and roarings mentioned by the previous witnesses. He has heard tell by a countryman who passed in the night that the howling was such that the countryman thought himself pursued by a pack of wolves, although it is well known that no wolf has been seen in these parts for 30 years. But the witness himself is of the opinion that the most singular of all the noises, and the one which always accompanied or foretold the worst storms, was a noise of flutes and pipes. Quod vulgo de conteur flustes et musets, so sweet that the King of France could not have sweeter at his court. Being interrogated whether he had ever seen anything, the witness answers that he has seen the church brightly lit up from the sands, but on approaching found all dark, save the light from the warder's chamber. That once, by moonlight, the piping and fluting and howling being uncommonly loud, he thought he had seen wolves and a human figure on the roof, but that he ran away from fear and cannot be sure. Item. His Lordship the Abbot desires the Right Reverend Prior to answer truly, placing his hand on the Gospels, whether or not he had himself heard such noises. The Right Reverend Prior denies ever having heard anything similar, but, being threatened with further proceedings, the rack, acknowledges that he had frequently been told of these noises by the warder on duty. Query: whether the Right Reverend Prior was ever told anything else by the warder? Answer: yes, but under the seal of confession. The last warder, moreover, the one killed by lightning, had been a reprobate priest, having committed the greatest crimes and obliged to take asylum, whom the prior had kept there on account of the difficulty of finding a man sufficiently courageous for the office. Query: whether the prior has ever questioned previous warders? Answer: that the warders were bound to reveal only in confession whatever they had heard, that the prior's predecessors had kept the seal of confession inviolate, and that, though unworthy, the prior himself desired to do alike. Query: what had become of the warder who had been found in a swoon after the occurrences of Halloween? Answer: that the prior does not know. The warder was crazy. The prior believes he was secluded for that reason. A disagreeable surprise had been, apparently, arranged for Prior Urbain de Luc, for the next entry states that, item: by order of His Magnificence the Lord Abbot, certain servants of the Lord Abbot aforesaid introduce Robert Baudouin, priest, once warder in the Church of the Holy Cross, who has been kept 10 years in prison by His Reverence the Prior, as being of unsound mind. Witness manifests great terror on finding himself in the presence of their lordships, and particularly of His Reverence the Prior, and refuses to speak, hiding his face in his hands and uttering shrieks. Being comforted with kind words by those present, nay, even most graciously by my lord the abbot himself, Etienne, threatened with the rack if he continued obdurate, this witness deposes as follows, not without much lamentation, shrieking, and senseless jabber after the manner of madmen. Query: can he remember what happened on the Vigil of All Saints in the Church of Junes before he swooned on the floor of the church? Answer: he cannot. It would be sin to speak of such things before great spiritual lords. Moreover, he is but an ignorant man and also mad. Moreover, his hunger is great. Being given white bread from the Lord Abbot's own table, witness is again cross-questioned. Query: what can he remember of the events of the Vigil of All Saints? Answer: thinks he was not always mad. Thinks he has not always been in prison. Thinks he once went in a boat on sea, etc. Query: does witness think he has ever been in the Church of Junes? Answer: cannot remember, but is sure that he was not always in prison. Query: has witness ever heard anything like that? My lord the abbot having secretly ordered that a certain fool in his service, an excellent musician, should suddenly play the pipes behind the arras. At which sound witness began to tremble and sob and fall on his knees, and catch hold of the robe even of my lord the abbot, hiding his head therein. Query: wherefore does he feel such terror, being in the fatherly presence of so clement a prince as the Lord Abbot? Answer: that witness cannot stand the piping any longer, that it freezes his blood, that he has told the prior many times that he will not remain any longer in the warder's chamber, that he is afraid for his life, that he dare not make the sign of the cross nor say his prayers for fear of the great wild man, that the great wild man took the cross and broke it in two and played at quoits with it in the nave, that all the wolves trooped down from the roof howling and danced on their hind legs while the great wild man played the pipes on the high altar, that witness had surrounded himself with a hedge of little crosses made of broken rye straw to keep off the great wild man from the warder's chamber. Ah, ah, ah! He is piping again! The wolves are howling! He is raising the tempest! Item: that no further information can be extracted from witness, who falls on the floor like one possessed, and has to be removed from the presence of his lordship the abbot and his reverence the prior. Part 3. Here the minutes of the inquest break off. Did those great spiritual dignitaries ever get to learn more about the terrible doings in the Church of Junes? Did they ever guess at their cause? For there was a cause, said the antiquary, folding his spectacles after reading me these notes. or, more strictly, the cause still exists, and you will understand, though those learned priests of 6 centuries ago could not. And rising, he fetched a key from a shelf and preceded me into the yard of his house, situated on the Nis, a mile below Dunes. Between the low steadings one saw the salt marsh, lilac with sea lavender, the island of birds, a great sandbank at the mouth of the Nis, where every kind of seafowl gathers, and beyond, the angry white-crested sea under an angry orange afterglow. On the other side, inland, and appearing above the farm roofs, stood the Church of Dunes, its pointed belfry and jagged outlines of gables and buttresses and gargoyles and wind-warped pines black against the easterly sky of ominous livid red. "I told you," said the antiquary, stopping with the key in the lock of a big outhouse, "that there had been a substitution, that the crucifix at present at Dunes is not the one miraculously cast up by the storm of 1195. I believe the present one may be identified as a life-size statue, for which a receipt exists in the archives of Arras, furnished to the abbot of Saint-Loup by Estienne Lemar and Guillaume Pernel, stonemasons in the year 1299. That is to say, the year of the inquest and of the cessation of all supernatural occurrences at Dunes. As to the original effigy, you shall see it and understand everything." The antiquary opened the door of a sloping, vaulted passage, lit a lantern, and led the way. It was evidently the cellar of some medieval building, and a scent of wine, of damp wood, and of fir branches from innumerable stacked-up faggots filled the darkness among thick-set columns. "Here," said the antiquary, raising his lantern, "he was buried beneath this vault, and they had run an iron stake through his middle, like a vampire, to prevent his rising." The effigy was erect against the dark wall, surrounded by brushwood. It was more than life-size, nude, the arms broken off at the shoulders, the head, with stubbly beard and clotted hair, drawn up with an effort, the face contracted with agony, the muscles dragged as of one hanging crucified, and feet bound together with a rope. The figure was familiar to me in various galleries. I came forward to examine the ear. It was leaf-shaped. "Ah, you have understood the whole mystery," said the antiquary. "I have understood," I answered, not knowing how far his thought really went, "that this supposed statue of Christ is an antique satyr, a Marsyas awaiting his punishment." The antiquary nodded. "Exactly," he said dryly. "That is the whole explanation. Only I think the abbot and the prior were not so wrong to drive the iron stake through him when they removed him from the church."
The Horla by Guy de Maupassant. Guy de Maupassant, 1850-1893, was born in Normandy, France, to an old and distinguished family. His parents divorced when he was 11, and his mother was befriended by Gustave Flaubert, who took an interest in her elder son, becoming his literary mentor. Immediately after graduating high school, Maupassant served with distinction in the Franco-Prussian War, then took a job as a civil servant for nearly 10 years. He was beginning to write, first poetry, which was undistinguished, then short stories, most of which Flaubert forced him to discard as unworthy. When his first story was published in a collection with the work of such literary lions of the day as Émile Zola, it outshone them all, and his future was secured. Over the next decade, he wrote more than 300 short stories, 6 novels, 3 travel books, poetry, several plays, and more than 300 magazine articles. His naturalistic style was a powerful influence on other great short story writers, including O. Henry and W. Somerset Maugham. Unfortunately, Maupassant died before his 43rd birthday. As an ardent womanizer, he contracted syphilis when he was quite young and suffered from other ailments as well. His brother died in an insane asylum, and when Maupassant felt he was losing his mind, he twice attempted suicide. He died a lunatic. Le Horla was first published in Gil Blas, October 26, 1886. Its first publication in book form was in 1887, Paris, Paul Ollendorf.
The Orla by Guy de Maupassant, read by Steve West. May 8th. What a lovely day. I have spent all the morning lying in the grass in front of my house, under the enormous plane tree that shades the whole of it. I like this part of the country, and I like to live here because I am attached to it by old associations, by those deep and delicate roots which attach man to the soil on which his ancestors were born and died, which attach him to the ideas and usages of the place as well as to the food, to local expressions, to the peculiar twang of the peasants, to the smell of the soil, of the villages, and of the atmosphere itself. I love my house in which I grew up. From my windows I can see the Seine which flows alongside my garden. On the other side of the high road, almost through my grounds, the great and wide Seine which goes to Rouen and Havre, and is covered with boats passing to and fro. On the left, down yonder, lies Rouen, that large town with its blue roofs, under its pointed Gothic towers. These are innumerable, slender or broad, dominated by the spire of the cathedral, and full of bells which sound through the blue air on fine mornings, sending their sweet and distant iron clang even as far as my home. That song of the metal, which the breeze wafts in my direction, now stronger and now weaker, according as the wind is stronger or lighter. What a delicious morning it was! About 11 o'clock, a long line of boats drawn by a steam tug as big as a fly, and which scarcely puffed while emitting its thick smoke, passed my gate. After 2 English schooners, whose red flag fluttered in space, there came a magnificent Brazilian three-master. It was perfectly white, and wonderfully clean and shining. I saluted it. I hardly knew why, except that the sight of the vessel gave me great pleasure. May 12th. I have had a slight feverish attack for the last few days, and I feel ill, or rather I feel low-spirited. Whence come those mysterious influences which change our happiness into discouragement and our self-confidence into diffidence? One might almost say that the air, the invisible air, is full of unknowable powers whose mysterious presence we have to endure. I wake up in the best spirits, with an inclination to sing. Why? I go down to the edge of the water, and suddenly, after walking a short distance, I return home wretched, as if some misfortune were awaiting me there. Why? Is it a cold shiver which, passing over my skin, has upset my nerves and given me low spirits? Is it the form of the clouds, the color of the sky, or the color of the surrounding objects, which is so changeable, that has troubled my thoughts as they passed before my eyes? Who can tell? Everything that we touch without knowing it, everything that we handle without feeling it, all that we meet without clearly distinguishing it, has a rapid, surprising, and inexplicable effect upon us and upon our senses, and through them, on our ideas and on our heart itself. How profound that mystery of the invisible is! We cannot fathom it with our miserable senses, with our eyes which are unable to perceive what is either too small or too great, too near to us or too far from us. Neither the inhabitants of a star nor a drop of water, nor with our ears that deceive us, for they transmit to us the vibrations of the air in sonorous notes. They are fairies who work the miracle of changing these vibrations into sounds, and by that metamorphosis give birth to music, which makes the silent motion of nature musical. With our sense of smell, which is less keen than that of a dog, with our sense of taste, which can scarcely distinguish the age of wine. Oh, if we only had other organs, which would work other miracles in our favor, what a number of fresh things we might discover around us. May 16th. I am ill, decidedly. I was so well last month. I am feverish, horribly feverish, or rather I am in a state of feverish enervation which makes my mind suffer as much as my body. I have continually that horrible sensation of some impending danger, that apprehension of some coming misfortune or of approaching death, that presentiment which is, no doubt, an attack of some illness which is still unknown, which germinates in the flesh and in the blood. May 17th. I have just come from consulting my physician, for I could no longer get any sleep. He said my pulse was rapid, my eyes dilated, my nerves highly strung, but there were no alarming symptoms. I must take a course of shower baths and of bromide of potassium. May 25th. No change. My condition is really very peculiar. As the evening comes on, an incomprehensible feeling of disquietude seizes me, just as if night concealed some threatening disaster. I dine hurriedly, and then try to read, but I do not understand the words and can scarcely distinguish the letters. Then I walk up and down my drawing room, oppressed by a feeling of confused and irresistible fear, the fear of sleep and fear of my bed. About 10 o'clock I go up to my room. As soon as I enter it, I double lock and bolt the door. I am afraid. Of what? Up to the present time, I have been afraid of nothing. I open my cupboards, I look under my bed, I listen. To what? Oh, how strange it is that a simple feeling of discomfort, impeded or heightened circulation, perhaps the irritation of a nerve filament, a slight congestion, a small disturbance in the imperfect, delicate functioning of our living machinery, may turn the most light-hearted of men into a melancholy one and make a coward of the bravest. Then I go to bed and wait for sleep as a man might wait for the executioner. I wait for its coming with dread, and my heart beats and my legs tremble, while my whole body shivers beneath the warmth of the bedclothes until all at once I fall asleep, as though one should plunge into a pool of stagnant water in order to drown. I do not feel it coming on as I did formerly, this perfidious sleep which is close to me and watching me, which is going to seize me by the head, to close my eyes and annihilate me. I sleep a long time, 2 or 3 hours perhaps, then a dream. No, a nightmare lays hold on me. I feel that I am in bed and asleep. I feel it and I know it. And I feel also that somebody is coming close to me, is looking at me, touching me, is getting onto my bed, is kneeling on my chest, is taking my neck between his hands and squeezing it with all his might in order to strangle me. I struggle, bound by that terrible sense of powerlessness which paralyzes us in our dreams. I try to cry out, but I cannot. I want to move. I cannot do so. I try with the most violent efforts and breathing hard to turn over and throw off this being who is crushing and suffocating me. I cannot. And then, suddenly, I wake up, trembling and bathed in perspiration. I light a candle and find that I am alone. And after that crisis, which occurs every night, I at length fall asleep and slumber tranquilly till morning. June 2nd. My condition has grown worse. What is the matter with me? The bromide does me no good, and the shower baths have no effect. Sometimes, in order to tire myself thoroughly, though I am fatigued enough already, I go for a walk in the forest of Rumar. I used to think at first that the fresh light and soft air, impregnated with the odor of herbs and leaves, would instill new blood into my veins and impart fresh energy to my heart. I turned into a broad hunting road, and then turned toward Labu. Through a narrow path, between 2 rows of exceedingly tall trees, which placed a thick green, almost black, roof between the sky and me, a sudden shiver ran through me, not a cold shiver, but a strange shiver of agony, and I hastened my steps, uneasy at being alone in the forest, afraid, stupidly and without reason, of the profound solitude. Suddenly it seemed to me as if I were being followed, that somebody was walking at my heels, close, quite close to me, near enough to touch me. I turned round suddenly, but I was alone. I saw nothing behind me except the straight, broad path, empty and bordered by high trees. horribly empty. Before me it also extended until it was lost in the distance and looked just the same. Terrible. I closed my eyes. Why? And then I began to turn round on one heel very quickly, just like a top. I nearly fell down, and opened my eyes. The trees were dancing round me, and the earth heaved. I was obliged to sit down. Then, I no longer remembered how I had come. What a strange idea! What a strange, strange idea! I did not in the least know. I started off to the right, and got back into the avenue which had led me into the middle of the forest. June 3rd. I have had a terrible night. I shall go away for a few weeks, for no doubt a journey will set me up again. July 2nd. I have come back quite cured, and have had a most delightful trip into the bargain. I have been to Mont Saint-Michel, which I had not seen before. What a sight when one arrives, as I did at Avranches, toward the end of the day. The town stands on a hill, and I was taken into the public garden at the extremity of the town. I uttered a cry of astonishment. An extraordinarily large bay lay extended before me, as far as my eyes could reach, between two hills which were lost to sight in the mist, and in the middle of this immense yellow bay, under a clear golden sky, a peculiar hill rose up, somber and pointed in the midst of the sand. The sun had just disappeared, and under the still flaming sky appeared the outline of that fantastic rock which bears on its summit a fantastic monument. At daybreak I went out to it. The tide was low, as it had been the night before, and I saw that wonderful abbey rise up before me as I approached it. After several hours walking, I reached the enormous mass of rocks which supports the little town, dominated by the great church. Having climbed the steep and narrow street, I entered the most wonderful Gothic building that has ever been built to God on earth, as large as a town, full of low rooms which seemed buried beneath vaulted roofs and lofty galleries supported by delicate columns. I entered this gigantic granite gem, which is as light as a bit of lace, covered with towers, with slender belfries, with spiral staircases, which raise their strange heads that bristle with chimeras, with devils, with fantastic animals, with monstrous flowers, to the blue sky by day and to the black sky by night, and are connected by finely carved arches. When I had reached the summit, I said to the monk who accompanied me, "Father, how happy you must be here." And he replied, "It is very windy here, monsieur." And so we began to talk while watching the rising tide, which ran over the sand and covered it as with a steel cuirass. And then the monk told me stories, all the old stories belonging to the place, legends, nothing but legends. One of them struck me forcibly. The country people, those belonging to the mount, declare that at night one can hear voices talking on the sands, and then that one hears two goats bleating, one with a strong, the other with a weak voice. Incredulous people declare that it is nothing but the cry of the seabirds, which occasionally resembles bleatings, and occasionally human lamentations. But belated fishermen swear that they have met an old shepherd wandering between tides on the sands around the little town. His head is completely concealed by his cloak, and he is followed by a billy goat with a man's face and a nanny goat with a woman's face, both having long white hair and talking incessantly and quarrelling in an unknown tongue. Then suddenly they cease and begin to bleat with all their might. "Do you believe it?" I asked the monk. "I scarcely know," he replied, and I continued, "If there are other beings besides ourselves on this earth, how comes it that we have not known it long since? Or why have you not seen them? How is it that I have not seen them?" He replied, "Do we see the 100,000th part of what exists? Look here. There is the wind. which is the strongest force in nature, which knocks down men and blows down buildings, destroys cliffs and casts great ships on the rocks. The wind which kills, which whistles, which sighs, which roars. Have you ever seen it? And can you see it? It exists for all that, however. I was silent before this simple reasoning. That man was a philosopher, or perhaps a fool. I could not say which exactly, so I held my tongue. What he had said had often been in my own thoughts. July 3rd. I have slept badly. Certainly there is some feverish influence here, for my coachman is suffering in the same way as I am. When I went back home yesterday, I noticed his singular paleness, and I asked him, "What is the matter with you, Jean?"
"The matter is that I never get any rest, and my nights devour my days. Since your departure, monsieur, there has been a spell over me."
However, the other servants are all well, but I am very much afraid of having another attack myself. July 4th. I am decidedly ill again, for my old nightmares have returned. Last night I felt somebody leaning on me and sucking my life from between my lips. Yes, he was sucking it out of my throat like a leech. Then he got up, satiated, and I woke up so exhausted, crushed, and weak that I could not move. If this continues for a few days, I shall certainly go away again. July 5th. Have I lost my reason? What happened last night is so strange that my head wanders when I think of it. I had locked my door, as I do now every evening, and then, being thirsty, I drank half a glass of water and accidentally noticed that the water bottle was full up to the cut glass stopper. Then I went to bed and fell into one of my terrible sleeps, from which I was aroused in about 2 hours by a still more frightful shock. Picture to yourself a sleeping man who is being murdered, and who wakes up with a knife in his lung, and whose breath rattles, who is covered with blood, and who can no longer breathe and is about to die, and does not understand. There you have it. Having recovered my senses, I was thirsty again. So I lit a candle and went to the table on which stood my water bottle. I lifted it up and tilted it over my glass, but nothing came out. It was empty. It was completely empty. At first I could not understand it at all, and then suddenly I was seized by such a terrible feeling that I had to sit down, or rather I fell into a chair. Then I sprang up suddenly to look about me. Then I sat down again, overcome by astonishment and fear in front of the transparent glass bottle. I looked at it with fixed eyes, trying to conjecture, and my hands trembled. Somebody had drunk the water, but who? I? I, without any doubt, it could surely only be I. In that case, I was a somnambulist. I lived without knowing it, that mysterious double life which makes us doubt whether there are not two beings in us, or whether a strange, unknowable, and invisible being does not at such moments, when our soul is in a state of torpor, animate our captive body which obeys this other being as it obeys us, and more than it obeys ourselves. Oh, who will understand my horrible agony? Who will understand the emotion of a man who is sound in mind, wide awake, full of common sense, who looks in horror through the glass of a water bottle for a little water that disappeared while he was asleep? I remained thus until it was daylight, without venturing to go to bed again. July 6th. I am going mad. Again, all the contents of my water bottle have been drunk during the night, or rather, I have drunk it. But is it I? Is it I? Who could it be? Who? Oh, God, am I going mad? Who will save me? July 10th. I have just been through some surprising ordeals. Decidedly, I am mad, and yet... On July 6th, before going to bed, I put some wine, milk, water, bread, and strawberries on my table. Somebody drank. I drank all the water and a little of the milk, but neither the wine, bread, nor the strawberries were touched. On the 7th of July, I renewed the same experiment with the same results, and on July 8th, I left out the water and the milk and nothing was touched. Lastly, on July 9th, I put only water and milk on my table, taking care to wrap up the bottles in white muslin and to tie down the stoppers. Then I rubbed my lips, my beard, and my hands with pencil lead and went to bed. Irresistible sleep seized me, which was soon followed by a terrible awakening. I had not moved, and there was no mark of lead on the sheets. I rushed to the table. The muslin round the bottles remained intact. I undid the string, trembling with fear. All the water had been drunk, and so had the milk. Oh, great God! I must start for Paris immediately. July 12th. Paris. I must have lost my head during the last few days. I must be the plaything of my enervated imagination, unless I am really a somnambulist, or that I have been under the power of one of those hitherto unexplained influences which are called suggestions. In any case, my mental state bordered on madness, and 24 hours of Paris sufficed to restore my equilibrium. Yesterday, after doing some business and paying some visits, which instilled fresh and invigorating air into my soul, I wound up the evening at the Théâtre Français. A play by Alexandre Dumas the Younger was being acted, and his active and powerful imagination completed my cure. Certainly, solitude is dangerous for active minds. We require around us men who can think and talk. When we are alone for a long time, we people space with phantoms. I returned along the boulevards to my hotel in excellent spirits. Amid the jostling of the crowd, I thought, not without irony, of my terrors and surmises of the previous week, because I had believed, yes, I had believed, that an invisible being lived beneath my roof. How weak our brains are! And how quickly they are terrified and led into error by a small, incomprehensible fact. Instead of saying simply, "I do not understand because I do not know the cause," we immediately imagine terrible mysteries and supernatural powers. July 14th, Fête of the Republic. I walked through the streets, amused as a child at the firecrackers and flags. Still, it is very foolish to be merry on a fixed date by government decree. The populace is an imbecile flock of sheep, now stupidly patient, and now in ferocious revolt. Say to it, "Amuse yourself," and it amuses itself. Say to it, "Vote for the emperor," and it votes for the emperor. And then say to it, "Vote for the republic," and it votes for the republic. Those who direct it are also stupid. Only instead of obeying men, they obey principles which can only be stupid, sterile, and false, for the very reason that they are principles, that is to say, ideas which are considered as certain and unchangeable in this world where one is certain of nothing, since light is an illusion and noise is an illusion. July 16th. I saw some things yesterday that troubled me very much. I was dining at the house of my cousin, Madame Sable, whose husband is colonel of the 76th Chasseurs at Limoges. There were two young women there, one of whom had married a medical man, Dr. Perron, who devotes much attention to nervous diseases and to the remarkable manifestations taking place at this moment under the influence of hypnotism and suggestion. He related to us at some length the wonderful results obtained by English scientists and by the doctors of the Nancy School, and the facts which he adduced appeared to me so strange that I declared that I was altogether incredulous. "We are," he declared, "on the point of discovering one of the most important secrets of nature. I mean to say, one of its most important secrets on this earth. For there are certainly others of a different kind of importance up in the stars yonder. Ever since man has thought, ever since he has been able to express and write down his thoughts, he has felt himself close to a mystery which is impenetrable to his gross and imperfect senses, and he endeavors to supplement through his intellect the inefficiency of his senses.
As long as that intellect remained in its elementary stage, these apparitions of invisible spirits assumed the forms that were commonplace, though terrifying. Then sprang the popular belief in the supernatural, the legends of wandering spirits, of fairies, of gnomes, ghosts, I might even say the legend of God. For our conceptions of the workman-creator from whatever religion they may have come down to us are certainly the most mediocre, the most stupid, and the most incredible inventions that ever sprang from the terrified brain of any human beings. Nothing is truer than what Voltaire says. God made man in his own image, but man has certainly paid him back in his own coin. However, for rather more than a century, men seem to have had a presentiment of something new. Mesmer and some others have put us on an unexpected track, and especially within the last 2 or 3 years, we have arrived at really surprising results. My cousin, who is also very incredulous, smiled, and Dr. Perron said to her, "Would you like me to try and send you to sleep, madame?" "Yes, certainly." She sat down in an easy chair, and he began to look at her fixedly, so as to fascinate her. I suddenly felt myself growing uncomfortable, my heart beating rapidly, and a choking sensation in my throat. I saw Madame Sable's eyes becoming heavy, her mouth twitching, and her bosom heaving, and at the end of 10 minutes she was asleep. "Go behind her," the doctor said to me, and I took a seat behind her. He put a visiting card into her hands and said to her, "This is a looking glass. What do you see in it?" And she replied, "I see my cousin."
"What is he doing?"
"He is twisting his mustache."
"And now?"
"He is taking a photograph out of his pocket."
"Whose photograph is it?"
"His own."
That was true, and the photograph had been given me that same evening at the hotel.
"What is his attitude in this portrait?"
"He is standing up with his hat in his hand."
She saw, therefore, on that card, on that piece of white pasteboard, as if she had seen it in a mirror. The young women were frightened and exclaimed, "That is enough, quite enough." But the doctor said to Madame Sable authoritatively,
"You rise at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning, and then you will go and call on your cousin at his hotel and ask him to lend you 5,000 francs, which your husband demands of you, and which he will ask for when he sets out on his coming journey."
Then he woke her up. On returning to my hotel, I thought over this curious séance, and I was assailed by doubts, not as to my cousin's absolute and undoubted good faith, for I had known her as well as if she were my own sister ever since she was a child, but as to a possible trick on the doctor's part. Had he not, perhaps, kept a glass hidden in his hand, which he showed to the young woman in her sleep at the same time as he did the card? Professional conjurers do things that are just as singular. So I went home and to bed, and this morning, at about 8:30, I was awakened by my valet, who said to me,
"Madame Sable has asked to see you immediately, monsieur."
I dressed hastily and went to her. She sat down in some agitation with her eyes on the floor, and without raising her veil, she said to me,
"My dear cousin, I am going to ask a great favor of you."
"What is it, cousin?"
"I do not like to tell you, and yet I must. I am in absolute need of 5,000 francs.
"What, you?"
"Yes, I, or rather my husband has asked me to procure them for him."
I was so thunderstruck that I stammered out my answers. I asked myself whether she had not really been making fun of me with Dr. Perron, if it was not merely a very well-acted farce which had been rehearsed beforehand. On looking at her attentively, however, all my doubts disappeared. She was trembling with grief. So painful was this step to her, and I was convinced that her throat was full of sobs. I knew that she was very rich, and I continued, "What? Has not your husband 5,000 francs at his disposal? Come, think. Are you sure that he commissioned you to ask me for them?" She hesitated for a few seconds, as if she were making a great effort to search her memory, and then she replied,
"Yes, yes, I'm quite sure of it."
"He has written to you?"
She hesitated again and reflected, and I guessed the torture of her thoughts. She did not know. She only knew that she was to borrow 5,000 francs off me for her husband. So she told a lie.
"Yes, he has written to me."
"When, pray, you did not mention it to me yesterday?"
"I received his letter this morning."
"Can you show it to me?"
No. It contained private matters, things too personal to ourselves. I burned it."
"So your husband runs into debt?" She hesitated again and then murmured,
I do not know."
Thereupon I said bluntly, "I have not 5,000 francs at my disposal at this moment, my dear cousin." She uttered a kind of cry as if she were in pain and said,
Oh, I beseech you to get them for me."
She got excited and clasped her hands as if she were praying to me. I heard her voice change its tone. She wept and stammered, harassed and dominated by the irresistible order that she had received.
Oh, I beg you to, if you knew what I am suffering, I want them today."
I had pity on her. "You shall have them by and by, I swear to you."
"Oh, thank you, how kind you are."
I continued, "Do you remember what took place at your house last night?"
"Yes."
"Do you remember that Dr. Perron sent you to sleep?"
"Yes."
"Oh, very well then. He ordered you to come to me this morning to borrow 5,000 francs, and at this moment you are obeying that suggestion." She considered for a few moments and then replied,
"But as it is my husband who wants them."
For a whole hour I tried to convince her, but could not succeed, and when she had gone I went to the doctor. He was just going out, and he listened to me with a smile and said, "Do you believe now?" "Yes, I cannot help it."
"Let us go to your cousin's."
She was already half asleep on a reclining chair, overcome with fatigue. The doctor felt her pulse, looked at her for some time with one hand raised toward her eyes, which she closed by degrees under the irresistible power of this magnetic influence, and when she was asleep he said,
"Your husband does not require the 5,000 francs any longer. You must, therefore, forget that you asked your cousin to lend them to you, and if he speaks to you about it, you will not understand him."
Then he woke her up, and I took out a pocketbook and said, "Here is what you asked me for this morning, my dear cousin." But she was so surprised that I did not venture to persist. Nevertheless, I tried to recall the circumstance to her, but she denied it vigorously, thought I was making fun of her, and, in the end, very nearly lost her temper. There, I have just come back, and I have not been able to eat any lunch, for this experiment has altogether upset me. July 19th. Many people to whom I told the adventure laughed at me. I no longer know what to think. The wise man says, it may be. July 21st. I dined at Bougival, and then I spent the evening at the boatman's ball. Decidedly, everything depends on place and surroundings. It would be the height of folly to believe in the supernatural on the Ile de la Grenouillère, but on top of Mont Saint-Michel, and in India, we are terribly influenced by our surroundings. I shall return home next week. July 30th. I came back to my own house yesterday. Everything is going on well. August 2nd. Nothing new. It is splendid weather, and I spend my days in watching the Seine flowing past. August 4th. Quarrels among my servants. They declare that the glasses are broken in the cupboards at night. The footman accuses the cook, who accuses the seamstress, who accuses the other two. Who is the culprit? It is a clever person who can tell. August 6th. This time I am not mad. I have seen. I can doubt no longer. I have seen it. I was walking at 2 o'clock among my rose trees in the full sunlight, in the walk bordered by autumn roses which are beginning to fall. As I stopped to look at a géant de bataille, which had 3 splendid blossoms, I distinctly saw the stalk of one of the roses near me bend, as if an invisible hand had bent it, and then break, as if that hand had picked it. Then the flower raised itself, following the curve which a hand would have described in carrying it toward a mouth, and it remained suspended in the transparent air, all alone and motionless, a terrible red spot, 3 yards from my eyes. In desperation, I rushed at it to take it. I found nothing. It had disappeared. Then I was seized with furious rage against myself, for a reasonable and serious man should not have such hallucinations. But was it an hallucination? I turned round to look for the stalk, and I found it at once, on the bush, freshly broken, between